Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Last Sunday, we took a look at Obama's first year in office in domestic politics. Let's turn now to foreign policy and back to discuss the first President Obama year in foreign affairs. With us again is Dr. Rob McDaniel, who is an associate professor of political science here at MTSU. Welcome back, Doc.
It is always a pleasure to be here, Jen.
And it's always a pleasure to have you. Obama inherited as much of a major mess in foreign affairs, if not more so, than he did in domestic affairs, including two wars and a battered American image overseas. But I'd like to start out with the tone of his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, a prize choice that stunned a great many people, conservatives and liberals alike. While acknowledging the greatness of King and Gandhi in his speech, Disciples of Nonviolence, and asserting that they were not naive or starry-eyed, he tempered that by saying King and Gandhi weren't heads of state. And he expanded on that with a nuanced explication, and I thought a very intelligent one, one of the most intelligent speeches he's ever given, and he's delivered many, of the just war concept that we learned about in studying St. Augustine. And so, in your view, did he provide, in that speech, a realistic template for dealing with the post-9/11 world?
Well, I think he did. It was a phenomenal speech, and it was praised by people on both sides of the political aisle. David Brooks and Ross Duhat at the New York Times, for example, who are their conservative columnists, were both very enthusiastic about that speech. Disappointed, I think, some people on the left who would have liked something that was a bit more peace-oriented, a bit more dovish, and yet they shouldn't have been surprised. Obama campaigned from the very beginning as wanting to get tougher in Afghanistan, but wanting to invest American resources in Afghanistan, recognizing that, in fact, the central front in the war on terror is in that lawless border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan, which is where Al-Qaeda has long held their training camps, and it's a breeding ground for a lot of the most dangerous movements that we have to deal with. And so
he said during the campaign that that was the war we should have been fighting all along instead of Iraq.
That's right. And, you know, I think one of the things that you say about Obama so far is that largely, you know, what you see is what you get with this guy, that what he campaigned on overwhelmingly is what he's doing. He's not surprising anybody that if you wanted to see what he was going to do in his first year in office, look to see what he said in the campaign. And what I think he said was very clear on foreign policy. He thought that Iraq was a bad idea from the beginning, that we had invested too much resources there and effectively diverted our attention from what was the central front in the war on terror, which was Afghanistan. And so it's really no surprise that in his first year, he has started dialing back our engagement in Iraq while dialing up our engagement in Afghanistan. Now, that may or may not work out well. Afghanistan has earned its reputation as the graveyard of empires.
For its topography, if nothing else, those mountains present more of an obstacle to anyone wanting to fight a war than anything else I can think of, including the nature of the guerrilla warfare.
That's right. And the culture there contributes to this. It is a localist culture. It is still predominantly tribal in its structure. The idea of promoting an Afghan nationalism is in some ways a noble ideal, an attempt to get Afghanistan moving into the modern age, and yet the realities on the ground are so difficult that it's going to be a very difficult task to do that, and so nation building there is extraordinarily difficult, and although Obama says we're not nation building, clearly to some extent we're trying to do some short-term nation building.
We've got a situation in both Pakistan and Afghanistan where we have rulers of governments we would rather not see in office. We have corruption in both countries is rampant. Yet I heard on NPR during the Afghan speech as a after the Afghan speech, immediately afterwards, as a reaction to it, that some soldiers are concerned that the battle for the hearts and minds is preventing them from being the warriors that they were trained to be. In other words, the hearts and minds initiative is going up against the military initiative, and instead of working side by side in the Afghan-Pakistan dilemma, they are rubbing up against each other and being counterproductive. How does that get reconciled as Obama and McChrystal try to engage in this surge of 30,000 more troops?
I don't know, and I'm not sure that anybody really has a good grasp on this. Part of the problem with Afghanistan is that there don't appear to be any good options. Now, one of the things that we haven't really tried and that now we're going to try is a significant infusion of troops, hoping that if we've got a larger troop presence on the ground, that will allow us to walk and chew gum at the same time so that, you know, we accomplish both. And if you look at what Obama has done in terms of troop presence, he has significantly ratcheted up our engagement in Afghanistan. The Bush administration had gradually increased our presence over the last several years in Afghanistan. Two, obviously recognizing that it was a problem that Afghanistan was falling apart. And so they had started some increases, but their increases were relatively mild. When Obama came into office, he initially raised troops from around 30,000 to around 68,000. So he more than doubled very early on, almost at the beginning of his administration, the amount of troops that we sent there. Now, the generals came back and said, as much of a mess as this place is, we need even more. We need 30, 40,000 more troops. And so most recently, Obama did a systematic program review. He looked at all the options. He rejected a lot of the early options that he was given before finally deciding on an increase of probably 30,000, maybe as many as 34,000 troops, moving us up closer to 98,000 or even more than 100,000 troops there, but with the idea that those troops would start to withdraw in July 2011. So in many ways, it is, right, that overused term. It's a surge. It's an attempt to create a huge short-term troop presence with the hope that they could create enough stabilization and institutionalize enough of the gains of the last couple of years that they would be able to withdraw in relatively short order. Now, whether or not that's going to happen, I think, is anybody's guess. But it's certainly something that we haven't really tried yet. It's something that we could have done if we had not lost, you know, stopped paying attention, and if we hadn't, you know, if we'd kept our eye on the ball and not immediately sent all of our troops to Iraq instead, back in 2001, 2002, when Afghanistan really started.
Do we have the military to pull this off? Because of the toll that Iraq has taken on the military, four and five rotations with some guys, post-traumatic stress disorder up, suicide up, the toll that is taken physically and emotionally on those troops is astounding.
That's right. It is. And it's a situation that I think that nobody likes. The men and women of the American military have sacrificed in extraordinary ways for these two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's hard to ask them to make an indefinite sacrifice where they would be expected to have these, you know, increased rotations and be on call effectively forever. You know, this is the difficulty with the Republican position on this. The Republicans, of course, who largely neglected Afghanistan, who created a lot of these problems by not investing in it at the beginning when it could have made a larger difference than it probably can make now, are now claiming that we need to commit even more troops and for an indefinite time period, an occupation without end. Now, that to me sounds like a recipe for complete disaster. I don't know how you possibly pull that off. Now, it doesn't mean that what Obama's doing will work either, but it means that he's in a situation where the alternatives that he has, the reasonable alternatives, given the resources that we have at our disposal, are severely constrained. And so they're going to make, I think, one last great effort to do what can be done in the space of a year and a half and hope that's enough.
Was he right or wrong to set a date certain for beginning to draw down in Afghanistan? This is something that the right has really gone after him for.
They are, and I think that it's about reality. As commander-in-chief, he has to acknowledge what the facts are, both on the ground in Afghanistan and in terms of what our troop levels are and the availability of our servicemen are for a long-term engagement. And we just can't afford to be in Afghanistan at high troop levels for 30 years. I don't see any plausible way that we pull that off. And in some ways, you know, being in a minority allows you to make irresponsible demands and not have to worry about consequences. And that's really what the Republicans, I think, are doing here. Because when they were in power, they certainly weren't willing to commit those troops to Afghanistan in any significant numbers. They largely just kicked the can down the road and hoped that things would kind of work itself out and that they could muddle through, to use a famous phrase that John McCain used about what our best strategy was in Afghanistan. And so, I think that Obama is at least facing up to the responsibilities and the difficulties of this year. But again, whether or not that's going to succeed is a tough one to gauge at this point.
Okay. Obama delivered an impressive speech in Cairo to try to reassure those of the Islamic faith that America is not anti-Muslim. A, do you think it was effective? And B, has he done enough to convince the Israelis that the U.S. relationship with them remains a priority?
Well, it depends on how you look at that. I think that he's made some really striking moves in terms of outreach to the Muslim world. Anti-Americanism obviously hasn't gone away. It would, I think, be expecting way too much to think that that a change from Bush to Obama would immediately overnight dissolve all the anti-Americanism of the world. But he's taken very important steps, I think, to restoring America's credibility with the rest of the world. And it's important that we do restore America's credibility with the Muslim community as well. Islam is a huge religion. It spans much of the world. And we depend on moderate Muslim states, on moderate Muslim populations, to be the front line in the war on terror.
Like our old friends in Jordan.
That's exactly right. We need these folks. And polarizing this debate, demonizing, stigmatizing Muslims as a fanatical other, really just drives more Muslims into the hands of groups like Al-Qaeda. And so what we need to do as much as possible is to create a unified front of Western nations and moderate Muslims and moderate Islamic nations against the kind of extremism that has caused so much problem, not only in the United States and Western Europe, but also in much of the world, with the upsurge of world terrorism over the last decade. We need to isolate those folks. We need to isolate the extremists. And everything that Obama can do to make the United States look less like an enemy is a step in the right direction. Now, has he done enough? It's hard to know. Diplomacy and this sort of outreach rhetoric tends to have long-term benefits, but it's often frustrating in the short term because you don't get immediate results. And you know, this is part of the difficulty of Obama's first year. Obama is giving us medicine, and I think it's true in the economic realm with the stimulus package and with healthcare reform. It's true in international affairs, whereas he's redirecting us away from a kind of bellicose, belligerent and much more military-focused strategy to one which engages diplomacy and soft power.
He has been quite a globetrotter in his first year, as has Secretary of State Clinton. Do you think that they have made generally favorable impressions on world leaders?
Oh, I think they've made overwhelmingly favorable impressions. But again, the things that the Obama administration is doing, they're the kinds of things that don't get you short-term popularity or short-term results, but that tend to pay off over time. In some ways, it's the exact inversion of the Bush administration. The Bush administration came in promising free candy. Domestically, that meant tax cuts for everyone, but especially the rich, of course.
And in Iraq, we will be greeted as liberators.
Well, that's right. And you know, when you start a war, your popularity goes through the roof because there's what political scientists call the rallying effect, where the American public rallies behind the commander-in-chief in a moment of crisis. But the candy they gave us short-term made us sick long-term. And so Bush was in a situation where he was able to cultivate short-term popularity, but long-term unpopularity as the effect of those policies sank in on the American public. Obama's in a position which is in some ways more difficult, which is that he's trying to give us medicine in the short term, which isn't necessarily going to have immediate results, and may not help the Democratic Party much in 2010, but that should bear fruits if you look at the long-term results.
He was cited by many pundits in a favorable way for not waving the flag and not creating the rallying effect in his speech at West Point, which was it's sort of counterintuitive for a president in wartime, but it was very refreshing to a great many people that he delivered a very pragmatic speech to the faces of the very people he would have to be sending into war. In other words, here's what I think, here's how I perceive the reality on the ground, here's what your role you were going to play in it, and I have the guts to say it to your face instead of hiding in some sort of a Rose Garden strategy. I'm not sure that's what David Axelrod was thinking when he was planning right. The optics of that particular address.
Well, it was sober. When I think about the speeches that President Obama has given in foreign policy recently, and I think about the Nobel Prize speech as an example of this too, the word that I think first and foremost is sobriety. It's been pragmatic, realistic, sober. It's recognized the complexity of the situation and yet tried to address that complexity with a kind of moral clarity that is, frankly, refreshing.
Stand up straight and look them in the eye when you tell them to eat their spinach.
That's exactly right. And coming after an administration that was really about the excesses of power. And conservatism, oddly enough, has become a kind of philosophy of decadence, one where unlimited power and the celebration of unlimited wealth that operate without restraints.
Which is actually a hangover from the 80s of the Reagan era.
Well, that's right. You know, it really is. It's a philosophy of decadence, a philosophy of operating without limits.
If the 80s was the party, the 90s was the coming down, and the beginning of the 21st century is hovering over the toilet and throwing up.
Well, I would argue that it was a relapse. It was an attempt to get rid of the hangover by going on a drunken binge.
A little hair of the dog that bit you?
That's right. But, we ended up in the toilet as a result of that. And so, you know, I think that that seeing that sobriety has been very refreshing. And as, for example, David Brooks, the conservative commentator from The New York Times, has noted that there was a strong dose of what we used to call Christian realism in Obama's speech in Oslo. And I think you saw the same thing in the speech that you were talking about to the military, where, you know, Obama recognizes the problem of dirty hands, the realities of power. These are grubby issues. There are no easy solutions, and yet we have to carefully work our way out of the messes that we have created.
And now what about Israel? He has met with Benjamin Netanyahu. However, I think Israelis were a little bit antsy about Obama during the campaign and had to be sort of reassured. I think that's what adding Rahm Emanuel to the staff in part was about. Not that Rahm Emanuel doesn't earn his stripes, but what is our relationship with the Israelis going to be like in an Obama administration that is focused a great deal on eradicating Muslim extremist terrorism and at the same time assuring the rest of the Muslim world that we're not anti-Muslim?
Well, I think that there are different communities that we're talking about here. First, we should note that, for example, that American Jews overwhelmingly support the Obama administration, that Jews voted for Obama over McCain by huge margins. And so Obama has a very good relationship with the American Jewish community, and that American Jewish community traditionally has supported Israel to a great degree. Now, where Obama has some problems is with the right wing, the kind of far right of both the American Jewish community and of Israeli politics, and Benjamin Netanyahu represents that kind of far right. And so I think that there are going to be limits to what Obama can do with the Netanyahu administration in Israel, that there are always going to be differences. Netanyahu has never been very sympathetic toward the peace process. He's always been a strong advocate of settlements. And so, to some extent, I think there's an impasse that just comes from the fact that you currently have a very far-right administration in place in Israel, and you have a kind of moderate center-left president in the United States. But I don't think any of that erodes Obama's basic support in the American Jewish community, and I don't think it really hurts him very much with Israelis in general. It's just, I think, again, it's a short-term impasse that can't be easily resolved. But I don't think that it's going to stay that way indefinitely. It's just that, again, I think people who are looking for short-term developments are going to have to really wait.
Okay. To me, he has had some unqualified successes. Obama has in his first year appointing Sonia Sotomayor to the U.S. Supreme Court, getting the Ledbetter bill passed to strengthen laws against gender-based wage discrimination, and winning the Nobel Peace Prize, even if some people believe it was terribly premature. And yet his approval rating has gone down in the polls precipitously since he took office. Does this bode ill for the future political leverage of Barack Obama, and does it bode ill for Democratic congressional candidates in 2010? Are they going to want Obama campaigning for and with them?
I think it depends on which Democrat you're talking about when it comes down to it. And we should note a couple things here. First of all is that the pattern of declining approval rating is the standard pattern. This is what always happens. The president comes into office having won election. He gets a boost from that. He gets typically a short honeymoon period, although Republicans tend to get more of a honeymoon period than Democrats as a general rule. But approval ratings always decline. And if you look at George Bush had less of a boost after the contested election of 2000. His approval ratings got a momentary boost, but then just started declining fairly quickly. And the only reason that Bush's approval went back up was because of 9/11. Which had nothing to do with what Bush himself actually did. It was a result of what we call the rallying effect, where in moments of crisis, the public overwhelmingly rallies behind the president. And so Democrats put aside their partisanship to embrace a president whose legitimacy they doubted in a moment of national crisis. And what that means is that Obama simply can't expect that kind of popularity because he doesn't have a similar event. And let's hope he doesn't have a similar event. If you combine that with the fact that we are in the midst of a huge recession, really the worst economic crisis America has faced since the Great Depression, that takes its toll on any president's support. And so I think that what you're seeing right now is really, it's two things. It has nothing to do with anything that Obama's actually passed legislatively or that he's fighting to pass. It has to do with the fact that presidents' approval always declines from their initial honeymoon burst. And secondly, that president's approval always declines during periods of economic recession, even if that president had nothing to do with creating the economic circumstances.
And so, was these Democratic members of Congress prepare for 2010, which they are doing even now. We see that John Tanner in West Tennessee has retired. We see that Bart Gordon in Middle Tennessee has retired. We see Republicans gearing up and preparing to attempt to take both of those congressional seats, just to bring it down to a microcosmic, you know, closer local level. How do you think that you can extrapolate from that to a national level? Is this happening in every state in the union? Of course, Republicans preparing for the election is, and Democrats preparing for the election is. But I mean, are there going to be more vulnerable seats for the Democrats this time around in this off-year election than, say, in past off-year elections?
Well, the pattern in off-year elections is the president's party always takes a beating. And it may be a little beating, it may be a big beating, but it's almost always a beating. The exceptions are, say, 2002, when we're still in the aftermath of 9/11 and Bush's high approval ratings because of the rallying effect and the war in Afghanistan, where Republicans actually pick up some seats. In 1998, where backlash against the Republicans' impeachment effort actually helps Democrats pick up some seats. Otherwise, the pattern is almost uniform that presidents' parties lose seats, especially when it follows a wave election. Almost always after a wave election, where one party sweeps in and has a huge mandate, like 2008, you have a retrenchment where those soft seats are lost. What we're facing here is a situation that's in some ways double that, because you had two consecutive wave elections, 2006, 2008. Democrats had just huge victories in both of those election cycles. And so any political scientist would tell you that you have to expect that Democrats are going to lose seats. The question is how many seats the Democrats are going to lose, and that's, I think, still up in the air. But I don't think that you're going to see something like 1994, because what happened then is that the South, which had been moving in a Republican direction for a couple of decades, finally decisively took that plunge. But a lot of those seats aren't there anymore. There are a few that are left. There's a few places in the South in particular where Obama is unpopular. And if you look at the polls, what you see is that Obama is still very popular among African Americans, among Hispanics. He's pretty popular among non-Southern whites. The group in the population that really hates Obama, and that has from the very beginning, is Southern whites. And so because of that, you know, people like Gordon and Tanner, I think, were probably facing tough battles, battles they could have won, but tough battles.
Well, we've only had 50 or 60 years to get used to integration. What the heck?
Well, that's right. It's not
I'm
all racial
facetious.
Anymore. I mean, you know, obviously values issues and abortion and those kind of things play into that, too. But
it is subtly racial on some levels.
No, there's a racial component, clear. I don't think you can deny that there's a racial element in some of this. But it's not the exclusive element by any means. And it's going to be a tough election no matter what. And it doesn't really have that much to do with what Obama himself has done in office. It's what you would expect in this election year. And so I think, you know, Democrats are going to take a hit. I don't know that it's going to be that big a hit. I don't know that it's going to be like it was in 1994 for Democrats. But I think if you look at the prognosis for the next couple of election cycles, 2010 will be a little rough for Democrats. 2012 looks like it could be fantastically good for Democrats, because Republicans don't really have any credible alternatives at this point. And again, it looks like Obama is doing the kind of long-term things that should help him 2, 3, 4 years down the road. But this next year is going to be tough, and Democrats just have to weather the storm.
Do you think the fractiousness in the Republican Party is going to continue up the through 2012? It would be unlikely for them to be able to get their act together to reconcile the moderates with the Sarah Palin wing and come to some sort of an agreement on leadership.
Well, the moderates are almost gone. I mean, there really is not much of a moderate wing in the Republican Party left anymore. That part of, I think, one of the, you know, that you, in politics, the best advantage you can have is your enemies. And the Republicans are really picking an insane long-term strategy, which is to double down on the most extreme elements within their own coalition. And, you know, I can't imagine that this wins them anything long-term. It's a strategy that might have some short-term payoffs, but long term, it's disastrously bad. And, you know, think about Sarah Palin and the rise in profile she's had. Obama and the Democrats' fondest dream is that Sarah Palin becomes the Republican candidate in 2012, because that is a recipe for a Democratic landslide, Obama winning by 20 points in the popular vote. And if that's where Republicans are going, and it looks like that's where they're going, it could be a very, very long, difficult decade for Republicans.
Because it's not just that die-hard base that turns out in the big general presidential elections. It's a lot of independents and people who will be utterly turned off by anything other than sane, sober, reasoned approaches to policy issues.
That's right. Midterm elections are base mobilization elections. You got to rally the base, rally the faithful. And so a little extremism in a midterm election is not a bad thing from a practical standpoint.
Or a presidential primary.
Or a presidential primary. But in a presidential general election, it is deadly. And Republicans are painting themselves into a corner here that it's going to be very difficult to get themselves out of in 2012.
Would you like to give him a letter grade, or shall we resist the urge to give him a letter grade that every Tom, Dick, and Harry has already engaged in?
Well, I'll
you
throw myself. I mean,
you specialize at giving letter grades to your students.
I think you got to give him at least a B+ at this point.
That's what he gives himself. That's what he gave himself on 60 Minutes.
I think that's that sounds reasonable to me. They've actually accomplished an incredible amount legislatively and practically in terms of what the economy has done and what's happened in world affairs. But you never know until later events shine a light on the early agenda.
Dr. Rob McDaniel, Associate Professor of Political Science at MTSU, thanks for being with us again for the second Sunday in a row.
Thanks, Jenna.
And exhausting your voice even more. This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. And you can listen to the podcast at your leisure, of course, at mtsunews.com. We're also available on iTunes. Happy New Year, and don't forget to eat your black-eyed peas.